Hello and welcome. It's time for another True Crime Tuesday, the best in True Crime Talk Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Every year, I start to cringe around the 22nd of November because I share my birthday, November 22nd, with one of the biggest tragedies in America's history, the assassination of a president and one of the most beloved presidents of our time. And we've hosted shows over the last 12 years of our series talking about the Kennedy conspiracies, and I've been on Coast to Coast AM hosting when I've talked about the Kennedy conspiracies. And after all of these years, 54 years, what is there left to talk about regarding Kennedy and the assassinations? Well, this year was a big year because this marked the year that they were going to release all of the files that had been locked up, all of the files that had been held back, and we would finally get that smoking gun. We would finally get some answers. So there's been a marked increase in interest in the Kennedy story. And then something was brought to my attention, a book by an author that told another story revolving around the JFK assassination and plot. The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, The Mysterious Death of What's My Line TV Star and Media Icon, Dorothy Kilgallen. And when I read the information regarding this book, I thought, this is something interesting. This is a different take, and it goes into so many different aspects of this case and this story. So we reached out, and luckily, we were able to get our guest for the evening, Mark Shaw, who is joining us. And Mark is a former criminal defense attorney and legal analyst for CNN, ESPN, and USA Today for Mike Tyson, O.J. Simpson, Kobe Bryant cases. Mark Shaw is an investigative reporter and the author of 25 books, including The Poison Patriarch, Miscarriage of Justice, and Beneath the Mask of Holiness. Mr. Shaw is a member of the American Society of Journalists and Authors. He's written for USA Today, Huffington Post, and the Aspen Daily News. And now he's slumming it with us on the show today. But it's great to have you with us, Mark. Thank you so much for being here.
Your birthday is on the 22nd?
It is. I'll be turning 50 years old on the 54th anniversary. Yeah, thank you very much.
That's really something. So do you know where you were when? Weren't born yet.
I was in my dad hanging out on the ocean somewhere as he was in the Navy at that time.
Goodness, so you've got a special interest in this, don't you?
Yeah, I do. You know, it was always kind of a bummer growing up to share your birthday with this day that was so maudlin and depressing. So for many years. I specifically stayed out of it. I just didn't. I learned nothing about it. I wanted nothing to do with it. It was just dark. But the storylines and all of these possible threads and weirdness to it, and everybody is so sure that they have an answer. And I guess that's what goes on. Why do you think, Mark, 50-plus years on, why is the JFK assassination still this great mystery that everybody wants to delve into?
Well, it is the greatest murder mystery in history because there's so many, you know, tangents you can go down with regard to it. You know, there are those people who want to look into the whole mechanics of the thing and you know the direction of the bullet or bullets that supposedly killed Kennedy. They want to look into everything with Daley Plaza and try to see whether somebody could shoot through a tree or not. They want to get into the the autopsy and whether it was legitimate or not. They want to know, some of them, whether it really was JFK who was killed, and then of course all the conspiracy theories and everything. So everybody finds something in the JFK assassination that they can latch onto, and I think that's why it's still today one of the most talked about things this time of the year.
I'm curious, again, having not grown up in that time period, not really understanding the whole deal, and hearing all of the things that have come out about Kennedy since. And I know that you wrote a book, The Poison Patriarch, which is about Joe Kennedy. And talk to me about the Kennedy family. I mean, how is this man considered to be such a legend, so beloved? But it just seems like John and his family were pretty dirty. I mean, they had their hands in a lot of illicit things to get to the point of power that they achieved.
Well, what you have to do, and we can do it a couple of ways, but one of them you have to go back let's start with this, if you don't mind. First of all, why did I write the book about Dorothy Kilgallen? Because it will bleed back into the whole Joe Kennedy thing. I wasn't going to. you know, it's amazing. I've written a lot of books, and yet this one has been more successful than any of them. It's become a bestseller. We just signed a deal for it to become a television series based on the true crime murder mystery part of Dorothy's story and her life. You know, it's just taken off, and I could never believe that something like that would happen, because I was like everybody else, Dave. I didn't know anything about Dorothy Kilgallen other than the fact that she was a star on What's My Line, a quiz show back in the 1950s and 60s, watched by 20 million people every Sunday night. And so I fell into this. And how did that happen? Well, I knew Melvin Belli, who was the main counsel for Jack Ruby. Mr. Belli practiced in San Francisco. I practiced law there for a while in his building. We became friends. When he died in 1996, I decided to write a book about him. So I did that. And I learned all of this about him, and I started to wonder about his mafia affiliation and why he used an insanity fence with Ruby. And then I talked to a friend of his, a doctor down in San Diego, and the guy said, well, you know, Bell, I knew Dorothy Kilgallen. And I said, well, what? He was on What's My Line? And the guy said, no, you don't know anything about her. She was this fascinating woman. She had this syndicated column in a newspaper in New York City, syndicated to 200 newspapers across the country. She was on What's My Line. She had a radio show every day with her husband that was listened to by a million people. And then, of course, she covered the most famous trials of the 20th century. Mark Dr. Sam Shepard, you know, that became the fugitive, you know, all of these trials. And she was at the Jack Ruby trial. I said, yeah, is that right? He said, yeah. And by the way, when she died, Mel said to me, you know, they've killed Dorothy. Now they'll go after Jack Ruby. And Dave, you're a curious guy like me. And so I kept that quote in my mind, but I didn't do anything with it. I then went, because I was suspicious of Belli's representation of Ruby and his mafia affiliations, I decided to trace all that back to Joe Kennedy. Well, here's what people need to know right away. Joe Kennedy wanted to be president of the United States. He had all the money in the world. Yes, he'd gotten into some underworld things with bootlegging and all that, but he was a tremendously smart investor. And he made this millions of dollars, and he wanted to be president, so a stepping stone was going to be him being appointed ambassador to Great Britain. So Joe went over there, and he made a big splash and everything, but he made a big mistake. He really showed an affection for Adolf Hitler. He didn't separate him from Hitler, himself from Hitler. He praised Hitler. He did this, he did that. And that really blemished Joe Kennedy's reputation. So when he came back to the United States, it was clear to him he could not be president of the United States. It wasn't going to happen. His reputation had gone south. So what did he want to do? He wanted to live through his children, as many do. And he wanted to make John Kennedy, first he wanted to make Joe Jr. president, but he died. And then he wanted to make John Kennedy president with the belief that he could then have Robert Kennedy as president and then Edward Kennedy as president. I know it's hard to believe, but that's what Joe believed. So I wrote the book, The Poison Patriarch. And once I was done with that book, and I really traced everything to the 60 election, when Joe used his connections with the mafia to have them help him win West Virginia and Illinois, and because Joe knew he couldn't win the election without that, and so they helped him, with the deal being that once they got in the White House, the administration would leave those guys alone. And those guys included Sam Giancana, Santo Trafficante, and a New Orleans mafioso named Carlos Marcello. And so what happened? Well, they got in the White House, and Bobby Kennedy was attorney general. He went after all those people. In The Poison Patriarch, I have a respected journalist who was right there when that happened, when Joe forced JFK to appoint Bobby attorney general, and he went after those guys, including Marcello. So that got me then to thinking, okay, I want to look more into this now, into Dorothy's situation, and that's what led me to finding out more about her life and then, of course, her death.
This is such a twisted, weird tale. And I think, you know, I think that's why people keep finding this fascination, Mark, right? As soon as you hear, you know, okay, we have Lee Harvey Oswald's the killer, people are fascinated by that aspect. Then there's the shadow of doubt that maybe there's something going on. And he's talking about being a patsy. What does that mean? Jack Ruby's involved. He kills Oswald. Then Ruby acts weird and talks. So it there's like one continual catalyst after another, and everybody's kind of taking and branching the story off into different aspects. And people are fascinated by our government and terrified by the fact that maybe our own government had a hand in killing the leader of our government. And
well, all that is possible, Dave.
Right.
All that is possible. But here's why, you know, I've said from the time this book came out, and I've had hundreds of emails from around the world agreeing. Dorothy didn't look at it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Dorothy
mm-hmm.
knew John Kennedy. They were friends. They socialized together in New York City. Remember, she's the most powerful female voice in America, the New York Post said. Hemingway said she was the greatest writer in the world. She was a big deal, and so Kennedy would have wanted to have a friendship with her. He had been to her home for a party. And then she took her son, Kerry, to the White House. And JFK made a big deal about Kerry. So when JFK died, Dorothy decided she was going to find out what happened to her friend. And right from the get-go, she is different than anybody who's ever written about the JFK assassination. Now, that's a bold statement, Dave, but that includes me, Vincent Bugliosi, Posner, all these other so-called assassination experts. What's the difference? Dorothy Kilgallen was there. If people go to the DorothyKilgallenStory.org, you will see her columns. You'll see interviews with people who knew her best, including Ruby co-counsel Joe Tannehill. You'll see photographs of her at the Ruby trial. You'll see a video of her at a news conference with Tannehill and Belli. Dorothy Kilgallen was there. She was an eyewitness to history. She sat in the front row at that trial. She's the only reporter in history out of all the 400 who were there to have interviewed Jack Ruby twice. She exposed his Warren Commission testimony before it was to be released. And she was there. She saw all this happening, and right away, she didn't believe what J. Edgar Hoover was shouting to the world, Oswald alone, Oswald alone, Oswald alone. Her first column that you can read at that website is "The Oswald File Must Not Close," 7 days after JFK died. And here's what Dorothy did. She focused on Jack Ruby. She felt, as I do, that Lee Harvey Oswald is a dead end. There's too much speculation out there. The Soviets, the Cubans, everything about him, they're dead ends. You get to a point where you've got to put so many different pieces of the puzzle together. Dorothy believed that it was Ruby who was the key, and that's who she focused on right when she got there to that trial. And that was how she headed her investigation. Ruby, not Oswald.
All right. She's involved in this to find what happened to her friend, to get involved in this history. And you were talking, again, I want to kind of vacillate between the two books a little bit. When you're talking about Joe Kennedy's aspirations mm-hmm. and getting his sons involved in this and by any means, do you believe that Kennedy, either Robert or John, were aware of the shadier dealings of their father in trying to get either one of them elected? Because in Bobby's case, Bobby seemed to really be the cleanest in appearance, at least in this family. Were they really understanding the machine that was running behind this Kennedy politics, or were they fully aware of it and they were just going along for the ride?
Well, you have to believe that, you know, it's hard to believe that they didn't know what was going on. Now, did they know about the deal with the mafia guys, including Marcello, to fix the 1960 election? We don't know for sure. But I think based on all of the research that's been done, I think that's what Dorothy believed. And she had, you know, followed all the nuances with what Joe had done during the 60 election. So it's hard to believe that they would not have known. Now, John, let's take them separately. John Kennedy, all the good things that are said about John Kennedy, and he has some warts as well. But it would be incredibly naive to believe that he didn't know what his father had done. With Robert Kennedy, you could say the same sort of thing, but we know through John Sigenthaler, who was a very respected journalist, was with the First Amendment Center. He worked for Bobby Kennedy at one time in the White House, very respected man that I interviewed myself, and he was right there at the time when basically Joe just forced John F. Kennedy to appoint Bobby Kennedy Attorney General, because John Kennedy did not want to do that. But you have to realize Joe did, because he wanted to have Jack Kennedy as president and then Bobby waiting in the wings. And Bobby then wanted to make a big deal for himself so that his reputation was enhanced. And when the time came, then he could run for president. So my belief is, based on primary sources, that both of them knew what was going on. And, you know, there wasn't any, for one thing, they weren't going to cross Joe. Joe was a very strong father. When Joe said jump, they jumped. So either one of them, I don't believe could have gone against Joe's wishes.
The idea that there's this kind of massive power play behind the Kennedys, just so people that are not as familiar with Joe's whole story, and believe it or not, there's still many people around the world who just have no understanding of really what was going on. How did Joe become so powerful and have such sway with people around the United States and in political parties and affiliations?
Well, you say father and son, you know. His father was like that. His Joe Kennedy's dad was a fixer in Boston in the political arena, always had his hands in different pies, including the underworld with the bootlegging and you know, all that money situation. Joe was as savvy as his father was with regard to investments, you know, linking up with the right people, making sure that they were getting a cut of everything that was going on during that time. And he accumulated quite a extensive wealth, but really where he made his money back then was in the investment field in New York City, and he was a savvy investor. I mean, when the stock market crash happened, Joe, I think it has been proven, had advance notice that that was going to happen and protected himself that way. So he ended up with just limitless amount of money. Joe also was very active in Hollywood, you may know. There's a good book written about that aspect of his life. But Joe ended up owning a film studio. I can't think of the name of it right now, in Hollywood. And so that gave him more power in the entertainment business. And he had affairs with several well-known actresses. He was, you know, he was all primed to run for president. There's no question about that. Well, but Joe's appetite for money is what caused him problems when he was ambassador for Great Britain, because through some intermediaries and even on his own, he made some deals with the German government when it was pretty apparent that Adolf Hitler wanted to rule the world. Joe didn't care because he was still making more money. So that's where he slipped up. And I believe that if that hadn't happened, that Joe would have run for president when he came back to the United States, because he had all the contacts, he had all the favors he needed, he had his hand in the underworld, which would help, and he had all the money that he could possibly need to finance a campaign.
John, did he have aspirations personally to take over and become president, or was this something that, again, because of a strong-willed father, he went in that general direction?
Oh, I think he knew he was primed when his older brother died. I don't think he had any choice. You know, he was next in line, and he was the next oldest. And you have to look at John Kennedy's political ladder. What was he? Wasn't he just a state representative, I think, even at first, and then he became and got into Congress, and then he ended up being a senator. And it's Joe that put him on that Senate subcommittee, and Bobby, too, that was investigating the James Hoffa and the mafia and all that. But what did that do? That put him on television. And Joe was very smart with regard to that kind of thing, and so was John Kennedy. And they both shined on television. They're both attractive men. And that gave him good exposure. I mean, again, you can just kind of see it all unfolding.
Right.
And I still believe that neither John Kennedy nor Bobby Kennedy had any say in this. Once Joe made up his mind that, he was going to, control the White House through his sons, that was going to happen.
If Joe was this powerful and the Kennedys were so revered, how did it get away from him? What do you think happened that suddenly there was assassination to take place?
Well, I like to call it a defining moment, and it's chronicled both in The Poison Patriarch and The Reporter Who Knew Too Much. Mm-hmm. You know, we set that up as a true crime murder mystery with Dorothy and everything, but it's chronicled in there. The mistake they made was appointing Bobby Attorney General. Because, you know, you have to remember, you can go to YouTube and watch those hearings, the MacArthur, McCarthy hearings, and also then the other set of racketeering hearings. And you see Bobby foaming at the mouth there as part of the questionnaires. And you see in a table, you see Carlos Marcello in his sunglasses. You see Santo Traficante. You see Sam Giancana. You see James Hoffa, and you know, they're just breathing fire because Bobby is after them all. Well, that was predictable then, that when he became Attorney General, he wasn't going to quit. And he hated Marcello, and he decided he was going to be the main target. So what did he do? 3 months after he was in office, he deported Marcello to Central America. When he got back in the country, he tried to deport him again. And on the very day that JFK died, and we can talk about Marcello's involvement there, Marcello was in a New Orleans courtroom charged with conspiracy, racketeering. And, you know, you can't mess around with those guys because Joe had promised them that they would leave them alone. You can't double-cross those people. And Joe Kennedy made that mistake there when he appointed Bobby Kennedy Attorney General. And there's even some conjecture, and I think it's pretty strong, that Joe tried to make Bobby settle down, and John Kennedy tried to make Bobby settle down and not, you know, go after those guys with such vigor. But once Bobby Kennedy got his hooks into Marcello and the others, he wasn't going to stop.
So was the assassination of Kennedy in response to stop Bobby, or was it in response to something that Joe Kennedy had done and pulled the strings on?
Well, what you have to understand is the mentality, the motive of Carlos Marcello. He was either going to go to prison or be deported as November of 1963 came around. He could not let that happen. His empire was worth billions of dollars. It stretched on to Dallas, where they would end up having the assassinations and all of that, and he had his underlings in Dallas. Jack Ruby was part of that whole group there. And so Marcello could not let this happen. Well, he's not a dumb guy, so what does he think? I want to kill that son of a gun, I'll say on the air, Bobby Kennedy, but if I do that, Dave, the whole government is going to come after me. Jack Kennedy will track me down and get me. There's no question about that. But wait a minute. If I kill John Kennedy, what happens? Bobby Kennedy is powerless, and that's exactly what happened. You have to look at motive with regard to getting rid of John Kennedy, and that is to make Bobby Kennedy powerless. You know, John Kennedy died at an early age, just like Dorothy did. Neither one should have died, but of course, Dorothy's death is then connected to John Kennedy's. But Kennedy was, JFK was not the target, it was Bobby, but they had to kill JFK to get rid of Bobby, and this is what happened. They never went after them again. Never happened, and Bobby finally resigned because he and LBJ hated each other. And those guys were never bothered by the LBJ administration.
Okay. Now we've kind of got the ground rules set in here. And I'm curious, and I want to get deep into your book as well, but explain to me the relevance and the importance of the information that has slowly been released here, this mm-hmm. the assassination information that's come out. Were you surprised by the lack of any new real damning evidence or information, or was that always expected, that if there truly was some kind of dark background, they would have destroyed those documents and we'd never see that in the light of day anyway?
Oh, who can be surprised at what the government does, no matter who's in the big house out there in Washington, D.C.? I mean, there's just so much that we don't know, and I wasn't surprised. I felt like that it would have been a surprise if all the documents would have been released. Dave, just think about it. I mean, this is 50-some years later. What in the world can be a reason for not providing the American public and the world with the truth? It's just mind-boggling. But there were a couple jewels in there of information that I found interesting, and that's two things. Number one had to do with Dorothy, actually, because remember, as I said, she was the only journalist who was shouting that the Oswald Alone theory made no sense. J. Edgar Hoover was very smart there. He moved everybody right away over to the Oswald alone theory. And he had a reason for doing that. What is it? Well, if it's a conspiracy of some sort, the mafia is involved, the CIA, whatever it may be, well then, he can be held responsible. The FBI should have known. They should have been able to stop that. But if it's some lone nut, like a Lee Harvey Oswald, then there's no way anybody could stop that. And that's what he said. Well, in those documents, there was one, and you can find it, that basically it was an FBI document, and it said, J. Edgar Hoover has made it clear that we are to issue statements stating that Lee Harvey Oswald and Lee Harvey Oswald alone is responsible for the death of John F. Kennedy. Now, I had never seen that document before in those strong a words. I always believed it happened, and Dorothy believed it happened as well. But that was of interest to me. The second one is that I've been able to, reader tips, find more witnesses to talk about what happened with Dorothy and what happened way back in the 1960s. And I've been privy to looking at, and I'll be able to use them in a follow-up book, the Jack Ruby trial transcripts. And in those transcripts, there's some revealing information that was at trial about Jack Ruby's relationship with the Dallas Police Department and the fact that he knew everybody there. Well, in this document, it basically talks about that there's an FBI document that says Jack Ruby has a really good in with the police department. They visited his bar, they were comped, all of that kind of thing. Well, that confirms the situation. And why is that important? It's important because in the Warren Commission report, you may remember, they absolutely said that did not happen, that right. He had no real friends in the police department. And, of course, then that connects in with the ludicrous belief. I think the two strongest ludicrous beliefs, if there are, about the JFK assassination is, number one, Oswald alone, and number two, Jack Ruby just happened to be in that basement on that day when Lee Harvey Oswald was being brought out. And I found some information in the Ruby trial transcripts that also deal with that, that I'll reveal in the book. But those are the two distortions of history that keep going. So there were a couple things in there that were of interest, and no, I wasn't surprised that we didn't get everything, but both of those things should help people make up their own mind that, hey, let's not buy all this Oswald alone stuff and really look into what is a much more clear path into figuring out what happened. And that's where I say, go to the library. You don't have to buy the book if you don't want to, but go to the library, get it, read what Dorothy investigated and researched, and see if her account doesn't make sense. Because again, as I say, she was there. She was there, an eyewitness to history.
Right. And that I guess, I understand, I gather. It just, trying to understand this too, with her getting involved in this and being close to the family, did they ever try to dissuade her from digging too deeply into this, realizing that there was a dark underlying kind of aggression that was taking place? You know, as a friend of the family, was there ever any warning, or did it go unheeded because she wanted the truth?
Yes, there was, and I would strongly suggest that people, whether they read the book or not, go to the DorothyKilgallenStory.org, because you will see more than 50 videotaped interviews. Yes, Joe Tannehill is on there talking about how the Ruby interview took place and where it took place in the courtroom. The last woman we believe to see Dorothy Kilgallen alive can talk about what happened that night, but there are two interviews. One with both with Dorothy Kilgallen's hairdressers, Mark Sinclair and Charles Simpson, who were her closest friends. And they talk about, both of them, in a chilling manner, what was going on before she died. And she told Mark Sinclair, if the wrong people knew what I know about the JFK assassination, it would cost me my life. She told Charles Simpson, I'm afraid for my life and my family. She bought a gun. She changed her will. She was afraid her son, Kerry, was going to be kidnapped. So I always felt like that was quite interesting. And then I was able to, the paperback edition of the book just came out in October, and some of this material is in there, this part. Tracked down Dorothy Kilgallen's butler's daughter. The butler is dead, but his daughter is still alive. I interviewed her for 4 hours in New York City in June. And she told me about the warnings that Dorothy got from her father and mother and from others to leave Jack Ruby alone, to leave the assassinations alone. You're dealing with dangerous people. I found the daughter of Dorothy Kilgallen, who it's a long story as to why she hasn't cooperated much with all this. It's disappointing, of course, but I found her best friend, and she talked about that she knew Dorothy was involved in the JFK assassination, and they were concerned about her. But you have to remember, Dorothy Kilgallen, what? The most powerful female voice in America, on television every Sunday night, radio show, everything. She thought she was invincible. And we can talk about what she did after she interviewed Jack Ruby, and she was writing this book for Random House. She had everything going for her in her life. And she was going to expose what she believed happened with the JFK assassination, but she couldn't imagine that anybody would harm her, even though she had bought a gun and told them that she was scared. She just didn't feel like anybody could get to her. Well, she was wrong.
Obviously. That's pretty terrifying, right? When you're trying to do your job, getting involved in this and trying to seek the answers and justice, and suddenly you're caught in the crosshairs of this story.
Well, a lot of people that I've heard from across the world have said, you know, she was a patriot. And, you know, Dorothy, she decided she was going to find out what happened. She told people right before she dies, I'm going to crack this case wide open. It's the case of a lifetime. And we can trace what she was doing, Dave, because once she interviewed Jack Ruby, she had a thick investigative file with her, which would later disappear when she died, but she made these notes with regard to Ruby and what he's told her. Joe Tannehill will, in the interview on the website there, says Ruby told her the truth as he knew it. And what did she do? She didn't stay in Dallas and look into the LBJ connection to JFK's death. She didn't go to Washington, D.C. and look into the CIA. She didn't go to Cuba. She didn't go anywhere. Where'd she go? New Orleans. Because Ruby, in my opinion, had told her something that she had figured out, that Ruby, Oswald, and Marcello were connected. And that isn't a stretch at all if you look at the primary source evidence. And so she went to New Orleans. She took her hairdresser, Mark Sinclair, with her, and then halfway through that trip said, go back to New York City right now and don't tell anybody you were here. She went back to New York City planning a second trip to New Orleans, and shortly after that, she was dead.
And talk to me about her investigations. Were there notepads? Were there anything left behind and anything that's been released in the current information to say what she had found and what was truly going on? Any damning information, or do you believe that was long ago buried?
Well, she had this thick investigative file. I found a photograph of her recently where she's holding some papers at the trial. She told everyone that she, you know, in those days you didn't make copies of anything. You couldn't go down the street to Kinko's or anything. She only had one copy and a carbon, but that's it. She kept it close to her. There's a primary witness who said she either never let that file out of her viewpoint. She had it with her all the time, or she had it under lock and key. We know she had it with her the night before that last show when she had on What's My Line on November 7th. We know that she had that with her because she showed some parts of the book she was writing to Bennett Cerf, who you may remember was a founder of Random House, but also one of the panelists on What's My Line. So we know she had it with her that night. Now, there are conflicting stories as to what happened to that file when they found her, as we'll talk about in a minute, I hope, in that apartment where she was found dead. Her husband first said that he had it, and then he said he destroyed it. But recently I found a witness who said that probably did not happen, that she would never have trusted him with anything. And so I have to believe that file is still out there somewhere. I have a hunch that it's in the FBI files, and I've tried to get documents from them. They gave me some at one point. I just think that file may be out there, and if we can find that file, we'll not only find out who killed her, but we'll have this incredible insight into exactly what she found out about the investigation.
So can I ask you a quick question here personally? You mm-hmm. see what happened to this most powerful woman. You see what happened to the Kennedy family for secrets that they tried to reveal. So I ask you this, Mark, why would you want to be the person to reopen and re-expose this? Is there no fear on your end for, you know, possible retaliation on you or your family members for digging this deep?
Well, Dave, you know, you go on the air and you say things and you mm-hmm. look into things with what you do. You're a man of the truth, I can tell. I did some research there. So you're putting yourself on the line. And I feel like, and people may think I'm crazy, but I think Dorothy pretty much chose me to write this story about her. You've got to think that for 50-some years, there was a book written in the 70s, but it was completely, it was incomplete. I have a feeling that she, for some reason, I feel blessed that she kind of chose me to write this story for her, to be her voice, because it's been buried for all those decades. And so, you know, you have a responsibility, just like you do, for me to go after this, and I did. Now, my Facebook page has been hacked. My email's been hacked. I've gotten some really crazy emails from people upset. But for the most part, I don't know, at last count, we've gotten more than 600 emails from people around the world. The book, as I said, has become a bestseller. And most of the comments, if you go to Amazon, I think there's almost 300 reviews up there. People have been very, you know, I'm humbled by what people have said. Thank you for bringing this story to our notice. We have great respect for Dorothy. Oh, how we wish there was a woman of integrity, a reporter of integrity today. So it's all worth it. Every once in a while, I suppose, when your imagination gets away and I start the car, I think, is somebody going to cause me a problem? But most everybody is dead. We do have a main suspect who's still alive in living in Ohio. He's named in the book, Ron Pataki, and I interviewed him twice. He was interviewed otherwise. There's some very conflicting comments and statements that he made. He wrote a couple poems that are very incriminating. I told him I was going to write this book, and I sent him a book, and I've been very upfront with him. But other than Ron, who's 82 years old, so far at least, nobody's come after me.
Well, that's good. All right. So, that, and I, like I said, I'm curious on that. And yes, I love truth and I love discussing this, but I don't go after one of the most closely guarded and obviously volatile subjects like the Kennedy assassination, like you do, trying to uncover the deep truths, because there's not only Kilgallen, there's the attachment to Marilyn Monroe's death also being part of this entire mix. So it just seems like anytime anybody has really gone deep into this, they end up on the wrong side of the ground. So it's, I'm always curious as a reporter, what keeps somebody moving forward on this and doesn't back off from doing a story. You're talking to people that you think are involved in this. Clearly I need to know where do you stand on the idea of Oswald? What was his participation level in this assassination?
Well, I happen to believe he was right when he said he was a patsy. I have to believe, based on the primary evidence that I've found that he was a part of the group of, if you want to call them soldiers or whatever you want to call them, that Marcello recruited, and he was somehow or another involved in the JFK assassination. Now, was he in that sixth floor nest up there in Dallas on Daley Plaza? I've been up there myself and been to Daley Plaza two or three times. Probably he may have been, who knows, but again, it's like with Marilyn Monroe's death. You mentioned that. Is there a connection to Dorothy's death? Well, look, they both supposedly died of, drug overdose, found in the bedroom, had their makeup, and hairpiece and different things on. I mean, there's a lot of connections there, but with Marilyn's death, there's a lot of speculation that you've got to do to be able to figure out what happened there. And it's the same thing with Oswald. And so, I haven't spent a lot of time with that. I just believe it's a dead end. Dorothy was right. It was Jack Ruby who was the key here, who was the connecting person to everybody. Dorothy believed what I do. Oswald was one of the soldiers that was responsible for JFK's death. Now he's a loose end. Well, what do you do? you bring in a Jack Ruby, a mafia wannabe who's connected to the police department, and he eliminates that loose end. Now you've got Jack Ruby. Well, what do? You bring in a mafioso-associated, affiliated lawyer named Melvin Belli, and he uses an insanity defense that made no sense, wouldn't let Ruby testify. And so now that loose end is tied up, and Marcello was smart enough to know that that's what he needed to do so that the arrow would not point at him as being involved. Well, who stands in the way now? There's only one person around who's questioning all of this that happened, and that is Dorothy Kilgallen.
You said that you felt she chose you to tell this story. Can you elaborate on that a little bit for me?
Well, you know, I believe anything, you know, or at least give it a shot. And I believe in the paranormal. I think these things don't happen by accident. I have felt her. I just got a chill saying that. I have felt her presence at times. I have felt that. You know, every time I can tell you, Dave, and you're a, I think you'll appreciate this. There were times when I was not going to keep going with the book. I had hit a dead end or something. I didn't know. It was like finding these videotaped interviews. I didn't know where I was going to be able to interview people that knew Dorothy Kilgallen. Well, it's a long story, but I came upon somebody who had. She and her colleague had been passionate about finding what happened to Dorothy, and in the late 1990s and early 2000s, they interviewed both hairdressers, Joe Tannehill, and this last woman to see Kilgallen. Well, I found out about that, and they had videotaped those interviews because all those people are dead. And so I felt like Dorothy directed me to this woman in Los Angeles. It took me 6 months to get her to trust me with those videos that people will see on the DorothyKilgallenStory.org. That didn't happen by accident, and it just seems like even now things will happen, or, you know, the readers have sent me a lot of tips and things, and even the other day a new one came along. I feel like Dorothy kind of is orchestrating all this, trying to help me along with finding out the truth as to what happened to her. Now, you'll have some listeners probably will say I should be in a mental hospital, but
no, not our listeners. They're into
this. I don't think there's any doubt. I don't think there's any doubt that she has been right there with me, her voice, leading me along.
It's interesting that you bring up that aspect, and the reason I questioned that was I have to be completely honest with you. I had no clue who Dorothy Kilgallen was, but I'm a huge fan of Groucho Marx. And I was stumbling through videos, I kid you, no more than about three, 4 weeks ago, and I fell into the trap that is Whose Line, or not Whose Line Is It, but What's Your Line?
And What's My Line?
What's My Line? Yeah.
And there's Groucho, right? Yeah.
Right, and I'm watching this, and I start watching this, and I'm introduced at that point to Dorothy, and I start watching more and more of the episodes that are online, fascinated by this, and I thought, wow, who is this woman? Why is she held in such high reverence at that time? And then literally within a couple of days, I'm pointed to your book and reach out to you. You answer immediately. So it does feel interesting how things orchestrate and come to synchronistic moments like
I wouldn't be surprised if Dorothy had a hand in that, of your Groucho Marx interest, and then you find that, and then you find me, and now you're kind enough to have me on the program. And, you know, it's still about, everything is still about what happened to Dorothy. And I told you, you know, she was scared. She went back to New York City. We know what she did the night before she died, that she was with this mystery man who I believe is Ron Pataki. And then she's found in this bedroom she never slept in, bed she didn't sleep in, her makeup on, her hairpiece. She's wearing clothes she never wore to bed. And yet, by golly, there's no investigation. They find an empty Secanol bottle, and all at once the medical examiner's office decides that she died of an overdose. There's no police investigation, and that's it. Dorothy disappears from the face of the earth. Now, why 50 some years later did she connect with me and guide me along? I don't know, but that's not any more of a ludicrous thought than the fact that she could have been inside your head somewhere or another and decided that, hey, Groucho Marx is somebody that's going to be a connection to that, and then this will give me another opportunity to be her voice.
That's a really intriguing aspect of all of this, just the weird synchronistic ties. Mm-hmm. But let's talk a little bit about her life prior to all of this. Was she, and that was a different time. There was, mm-hmm. you know, drinking and socializing and things like that. And they used to drink on some of these shows, right? It was part of it. Was she a known alcoholic or drug abuser? Did any of that information ever come out post her murder or death, suicide, whatever you want to refer to it as? Did any of that information come out that could actually be corroborated that, yes, she had a drug addiction or an issue?
Well, here's what happens way too often. Let's say that you pass away. Unfortunately, I hope that doesn't happen in a long time, but let's say it happens. And somebody says, well, you know what, he had a real drug problem and drank too much and, you know, that's probably what happened to him, that way. Well, that would be ludicrous, but it could happen. What you hope is when somebody says that to somebody else, they will say, you know what, I know Dave, that isn't him. He didn't have a drug problem. He wasn't an alcoholic. That's ridiculous. Well, let's then turn that to Dorothy Kilgallen. She did not have a drug problem. Joe Tannehill talks about seeing her just a few weeks before she died. Her mind was sharp. She had one drink. She had no drug problems of any kind. She used sleeping pills, is all we know. And yet, when she died, they put out this fraudulent autopsy, and I have completely thrown that to the wolves in the book with forensic evidence that contradicts any of that in an autopsy. But what happened? People just thought, oh, well, okay, God, Dorothy Kilgallen, entertainment, you know, all this. She must have been a drug addict and an alcoholic. Well, that was completely unfair. And
right, but all it takes is that shadow of doubt is just throw it out there and you say it.
Once it's in the newspaper,
right, it becomes fact.
Now, these days on the internet, everybody mm-hmm. believes it when it's just crazy. We talk about fake news. I mean, that's
right.
Really what that was. People have asked me, too, why didn't her family speak up? Why didn't the What's My Line colleagues speak up? Why didn't the journalists speak up? They all knew here. Well, they thought to themselves, wait a minute, she's working on the JFK assassination investigation. If the same people that killed JFK killed Dorothy, I'm not about to talk about this. And
right.
That's what happened. Nobody spoke up for Dorothy. Nobody said, that's not her. I don't believe this. We need an investigation. And basically the case was closed, miscarriage of justice, and I'm pleased that I've been able to reopen all of that and have people realize that her reputation, I hope, has been restored with at least, 20,000-30,000 people who have read this book.
Well, let me ask you this, then. If this is the case and that it was a shoddy workmanship done by the coroner's office, the medical examiners, mm-hmm. and CSI of its time, why mm-hmm. could the body not be exhumed now? There would be residual effects of whatever narcotics in the bone or whatever might be left over, right? Isn't that the theoretic idea, is that the body would still show traces of an overdose?
Well, you don't know this, but there have been several cover-ups with Dorothy's death. There was one in 1965, but 3 years later, and it's in the book,
mm-hmm.
Two toxicologists, one of whom I've interviewed, the wife and the son, one guy had kept her bodily fluids. He was a guy who kept that kind of thing. There's a medical word for doing that. Just in case the technology would improve down the road, and it did as of 1968. So they re-examined those bodily fluids, and they didn't find one barbiturate in Kilgallen's stomach. They found three. Right away, I mean, that's not conducive to, suicide, that she would have taken all those drugs. It's not conducive to an accidental death, that she would have taken all those drugs, so it points towards murder. Now, I got the New York District Attorney's Office to look into this, and thus far it's been really difficult for them, for me to get them to do the things that I want them to do. I don't know whether...
What is the answers that they give you that? What is the stonewalling that they're giving you? There has to be some kind of official response, or do they just not respond, period?
No, they've responded, but they really feel like, I think, that, you talk about cold cases. I mean, this is a long time ago, and we had five murders in the Bronx last night. We don't have time to be able to deal with this. I got cooperation along the road for a while, and then it didn't seem like they kind of lost interest in it. But You ask a good question about whether digging up her remains might provide some answers. But that's one thing that I had hoped perhaps they might look into doing. But thus far, that hasn't happened. Now, whether down the road with the new evidence and things that I've come up with that could happen, I don't know. But, you know, again, you just have to understand that for whatever reason, nobody stood up for Dorothy all those years ago. And it's just a tragedy.
I'm curious what your thought process is on this. I mean, obviously, our current president wants the truth out there. And he was, from my understanding, not thrilled with the fact that they were going to hold back some of the information. Couldn't the president be approached to do something like an exhumation and ask for a follow-up? And for people that say, well, it's a cold case, it shouldn't matter at this point. It's taking resources away from important cases now. It is an important part of our history, and it does seem that it should get some kind of play and some kind of attention, especially if you have the president of the United States who wants to get the answers out but is being stonewalled himself from doing so. This might be the kind of in that would reopen an investigation, which would force hands to kind of reevaluate the entire story.
Well, I tried this once before with the Poison Patriarch when I got all that new information and everything, and I wrote a strong letter to the head of the Judicial Committee in the Congress and all of that, a couple people there, and got one response that they didn't have any time to do something like that, and not a response from the other one. And I don't know, Dave, maybe I'm just, I don't know what I am these days, but I don't know if I would believe anybody pretty much in the government, unless they took a lie detector test and told me that it was true. I don't know if this president, you know, is he really looking for the truth out there? If he was, then for God's sakes, it's his decision. You know, all you got to do is say, hey, that's nice what you say, but I'm gonna throw this out there. Well, so everybody now is dubious of whether that was true, that he wanted to get everything out there, because if you want to, hell, you're the most powerful man in the world. Nobody can stop you. If I took that to them now with everything going on and all the investigations and everything, they'd laugh at me. I know they would. And so, again, the follow-up book is going to provide more evidence that, hey, we need to really figure out what happened to Dorothy, and perhaps I'll get some attention with regard to that. I just keep trying. Your show, again, I appreciate so much you're having me on. I'm going to keep fighting for Dorothy, but it's an uphill battle. I feel like a one-man band out there at times, so all I can do is keep trying.
You said that her daughter is still alive. Is that correct?
Yeah, her three kids are all alive.
And how did they react towards this story?
Well, you have to understand, the last days of their life were not good ones. They had a falling out, the daughter with Dorothy, over some things that Dorothy, she didn't feel like, they disagreed about, let's say that. And so then, you know, the determination is that Dorothy was an alcoholic and a drug addict. So that wasn't a pleasant thing for the three kids to believe, and you know, whether they believed it or not, I don't know. Then you have the fact that Dorothy's husband, Richard, was an alcoholic, and just a few years after Dorothy died, he committed suicide. So it's not a happy childhood. It's not a happy last few years with their parents, and there was some falling out with what happened there. So shortly after I decided to write the book, I got in touch with Jill, who's the daughter. I let her know what I was doing. And we had a short chat, and she just told me, you know, she's 70-some years old now. She wasn't interested in getting involved in this. A journalist for the New York Post talked to her and got the same reaction, although she did admit that she felt like something had happened to her mother other than the accidental death. Her best friend, Jill's best friend, told me that in the 1970s she was at a dinner. Another fella also was at that dinner, who both told me that Dorothy had said, my mother was murdered. So I keep after it. Maybe at some point when I'm down in L.A., we're, as I said, working on this television series based on Dorothy's life, I may just show up at Jill's doorstep. And either she'll hit me in the mouth or something, or she'll talk to me. I don't know, but I'm going to keep after this and keep trying to open those closed doors that are still out there.
Do you think that we're ever really going to get any kind of release of information on any aspect of the Kennedy case and the affiliated deaths and murders? Because it is alarming the amount of people tied to that case that died. And died suddenly, tragically, in suicide, in all different forms. Do you think we're really going to ever get that answer? Or do you think that, I know you want that, to happen. You want to get the answer for Dorothy. But do you really believe that there will be a time when history reveals itself?
Well, I'll tell you where I think history would reveal itself. If we can find Dorothy Kilgallen's file. I still believe, Dave, and people can make up their own minds. They can go on all these tangents and looking at the different conspiracy theories and everything else. But, you know, I hope that they'll give Dorothy a shot, that they'll, you know, either buy the book. The paperback just came out last month. Go to the website, look at all the videos and everything else like that. Look at all of her columns. You know, you have to think about how admired she was. My favorite photo is one of her at the Dr. Sam Shepard case. It's up on that website. And all these journalists are surrounding Dorothy, looking at her with admiration. I mean, she was an idol to them. She was a woman of integrity. She didn't she didn't decide on a conclusion and then make the facts fit to it. She did it the other way around. She did it hard work, finding facts, and then drawing her conclusions. So I think that, you know, people can find the book at the library, wherever they want to, but give her version of what happened a shot, because again, as I say, she was there. So what would more authenticate what she was doing if we can find that file? And I will never give up until my last breath trying to find that file, because if we find that, as I think would have happened back then, if she would have publish what she had found out, the course of history would have been changed. It would have been changed for the better. I think we would have known much more about what happened to John F. Kennedy in 1963.
Do you believe that that file truly exists, or do you believe that it has been destroyed?
Well, I gotta hope Dorothy's going to lead me to it at some
right.
point.
Well, yeah, we all want that for the answers.
She's opened. Yeah, well, you know, she knows where it is. And again, as I say, she's kind of run this whole thing, and I'm just her conduit. I'm just her voice. And
with that said, then, have you ever considered, since you're involved in the paranormal and interested in the paranormal, have you ever considered seeking spiritual counseling on it and speaking to someone who might be able to channel a more direct line of information that could help lead you to these points?
Well, there's an expert in that area in New York City, and I haven't gotten back there since June. And when I do, and I think I will, that is something I may give a shot to. I have to watch really closely. You know how it is when you feel like somebody is really influencing the decisions that you make. I have to listen. And so the most innocuous things have come up, and I decided, hey, maybe Dorothy wants me to go in that direction, and I did, and it paid off. So if she told me, if I got the feeling this afternoon that I could go across to a church from my home, that the file is hidden in the wall, I'd go.
Well,
I'd go over there, see if that damn file's in there. So we'll see what happens, but I'm gonna keep after this.
It was a different time. I mean, the political and media association was one where we protected our president. We protected a lot of the illicit things that went on in celebrities' lives. We did things differently than we do today. Today it's let's expose as much and as fast as we can, facts be damned. Back then, people took the time to really kind of flesh out stories and try to understand it, and they understood the respect needed for certain political offices. And even though you might find something disturbing, it wasn't a rush to print to, you know, discredit themselves, the president, or even cast aspersions that they didn't know 100%. So she was on to something that she felt very good about. When she was releasing the articles up to that time, how were people reacting to her at the moment? Were people taking deep notice, or was she being discounted and was there a war being waged on her already in life before her death?
Well, certainly, you know, Hoover was yelling and screaming. I have an FBI file that shows where he had one column and he took his through his own hand, wrong, 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 besides what she had written. But in the public arena, I don't believe that, you know, people wanted to believe back then, and Hoover took advantage of this. They wanted to believe that it was Oswald alone. They wanted to believe that they were safe, that they found the guy who killed JFK, and so...
Right, and that's one of the big points that they've made about the documents that were released, that Hoover immediately said, you make sure that this mm-hmm. sticks and that Oswald is yeah. it. Do you believe he was standing on the right of justice where he was like, we need to show the country that we're strong and we've got our answers, or do you believe that he was really involved in a cover-up?
Oh, I think that's happened throughout history with presidents and everybody else in government where they can... basically use that excuse saying, well, I'm doing this for the benefit of the American public by not revealing this or whatever else it might be. And, you know, people do want to know the truth, I believe. And yet they want to say, well, you know, that wouldn't be good for them. They shouldn't know this because then they'll be scared or they'll be this or they'll be that. Well, that always comes back to haunt the whole situation because, the untruth leads to another untruth.
Well, then let's play the hand out. Okay, then let's play the hand out. Let's play the what-if game in this sense. I'm just curious. If we were able to release all of the documents and we came out with Dorothy's manuscript that she had been writing and was missing her file, and we were able to expose that Kennedy was assassinated, that it was LBJ behind it, and that, President Nixon was the one who personally killed Kilgallen. And, you know, I mean, we were able to draw this conclusion. We said this is exactly what's going on. What do you think that the overall ramifications would be in our country and around the world if that information was ever corroborated and proven?
Well, there are those people who are just not going to buy it no matter what. They, mm-hmm. you know, older people especially, 50 plus or whatever, they've been so schooled into believing it was Oswald alone that I don't think if you had 25 witnesses that came, to and appeared and said that isn't true, that they would buy it. Now, people are skeptical. And it's just easy for him to say it was Oswald alone. I don't want to hear anything else that way. I've had that happen with regard to many of the media interviews that I've had, where I'll say the same things that I said today, and then a caller will call in and just say, you know, Mr. Shaw, I appreciate what you've done, but you're just full of you know what. I don't know where you're getting this material, despite the fact that I can then say to them, go to the website, the DorothyKilgallenStory.org, and look at these interviews. Look at Dorothy being there. You realize she was there, and none of these other so-called experts were. Well, that doesn't make any difference, and so you're not going to change people's minds, Dave. All you can do is make them stop and think.
I agree. But I think with these papers having been released, if there was a thread and we were able to put that out there, you're still going to have a minority that will believe that there was still something, a totally different aspect, or believe that aliens were behind it. I mean, I understand that there's always going to be that line, mm-hmm. just like you've got people out there who believe that nobody was shot in Sandy Hook, that it was all just a trial run and no children died. You have people that fully, wholeheartedly believe that, and they have nothing to go on other than what they've read on the internet and piecing mm-hmm. together their own disjointed puzzle. So I understand mm-hmm. that aspect of it. But don't you think that if the government was to come forward and be forthcoming, whether it's in the JFK plot or in things like aliens, don't you think that would discredit and undermine our government to a place where we may never recover? Because if we can kill our own president, mm-hmm. right? You see where I'm going with that, which has always been the question. We want to know, but like in the immortal words of Jack Nicholson, you can't handle the truth.
I knew you were going to bring that up. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But it is. And understand, I'm not being an apologist for the right, conspiracy right. and hiding it. But I often wonder what would the ramifications be much worse for us, our countries and our allies, if they knew that, you know, we all know that there's weird stuff going on. But if there was confirmation 100% and everybody agreed upon this fact that this is how it did go down and that that Oswald was a patsy and that there were three shooters from three different vantage points, and that Fidel Castro, LBJ, and Sam Giancana were all behind this plot to kill him, and all of that was revealed. Don't you think that the overall destructive nature of that revelation would uncouple our country completely? I mean, we're already in a state of upheaval, and in a way that's never been worse, but is there a clear winner in finally revealing the truth in a case like this? Or is it time we put it to bed and move on and just focus on making the world better now and disrupting political careers that are not in the best interest of the people?
Well, you know, boy, those are really tough questions. And when you say people, I mean, generalizing, I mean, it's just so difficult to tell because, you know, you have to look at the age of people who would be responding to that kind of evidence. I don't know. I feel like that we're at a time where people are more skeptical than any time in history. They just don't know what to think. You know, I was asked the other day, you know, Mark, could you name a journalist that is the most respected in the country or a television news person that's most respected person in the country? I don't know who that would be. We had Walter Cronkite. We had Brinkley. We had, you know, these bigger-than-life people. And when we turned on the news, we really believed what was coming out of their mouth. But these days, with the fast pace, you know, everybody trying to beat everybody with a headline and all of that, I mean, look at today. I'm going to just bring this up, and I don't know whether this will be confirmed or not, but maybe you've read. I mean, look at a man like Charlie Rose, who's been admired all through the years and thought of as an honest journalist, interviewer, all those kind of things. Well, today we find out there's eight women who say they were sexually harassed by him, and I read a little bit of that material today. And, you know, it's just so mind-boggling to think that kind of thing can come on and come about. And so, if he's that kind of a person, and I hope there will be people who come to his defense. If it isn't true, he's admitted some of it is. But if that happens, we have to wonder, you know, the credibility of things that he has said, books he's written, all that through the years, because that's a sickness. There's a sickness there. And that's happened with many people here recently. So we're at a time when we need to clean up our act with regard to what's going on. And somebody, the only thing you can do with your program is to point things out to people and have them question things, have them make sure that they question things. And that brings me around to what you've said. If some evidence came about that really people could bite into, would it make a difference in their opinion? And I think it would depend, again, on their age and background and whether they really want to know the truth.
And I know you touched on it briefly, but walk me through the last few hours of Kilgallen's life, I should say. She was seen doing what, where, when, and with who. What can you tell me about that aspect?
Well, she's at home, and Mark she's at her townhouse on East 68th Street, and Mark Sinclair, her hairdresser, comes over, and he fixes her hair. And she's getting ready to go to What's My Line. She takes a limousine over there. He notices she's wearing a different dress, and instead of a fashionable dress, she's wearing a dress that she would normally wear on a date, even though it's fashionable, too. On the show, first of all, before the show, she shows Bennett Cerf part of her manuscript. On the show, if you want to really see what her mental makeup is and her physical makeup, just go right into the YouTube and watch that final show. It's on there, November 8th, 1965. And she's sharp as can be. She guesses the woman, the last woman to see her alive, that she sells dynamite. She leaves there and she goes to P.J. Clark's with one of the producers in the show, and then she ends up at the Regency Hotel. And that's where she meets this mystery man who I think most everybody who's read the book believes is Ron Pataki, as I do. Then she's found the next morning dead in this bedroom, supposedly of an overdose of barbiturates and alcohol. So that traces the whole afternoon, evening, and morning of Dorothy Kilgallen, the last days of her life. And from that point on, she basically just disappears from view. There's a a funeral with 10,000 people showing up and all of that, and then after that, she just slides away and is very seldom even mentioned.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. Why do you believe that it was him? Why do you believe he was the mystery man? What have you found out specifically that, in your mind, quells that answer?
Well, what people need to do is to look at the book, and you will see two poems that he wrote. They both, Ron said, are humorous poems, but one of them has to do with shutting the mouth of a person who's writing a typewriter, typing a typewriter. And the other one has to do with poisoning a drink. And he has a little cartoon with it. And those are the most incriminating things, because we believe that Dorothy's drink was spiked with barbiturates either at the Regency Hotel bar or when she got home that night. And there, it's just common sense. She was going out with Pataki. She had shared her JFK investigation information with him. She believed he was leaking it to the wrong people. The pile of evidence towards him is very, very strong. But again, I'll let people make up their own mind.
That's fair enough. You've got the book. You get it in the hands of people. And I know the hopes is this is going to open up more eyes. It's going to bring more people into this possibility. What do you hope is the overall effect? Is there anything that we, the people, can do to insist that cases like this are not just pushed aside and that they're not forgotten and that we can do something? Is there anything, or are we really a powerless nation of rubes who, you know, we can educate ourselves and learn it, but we're not going to make any difference?
Well, I don't want to ever believe that that's true. If people do read the book, and if they do look at the material up on the website, the DorothyKilgallenStory.org, look at all those videos, look at her columns, look at everything else. If they believe that there should be a really thorough investigation of Dorothy's death, they can write to the New York District Attorney's Office, Cy Vance Jr., and tell them what they feel, that that this needs to be investigated, that we need to get to the truth. They can check with their congressman. They can check with anybody. They can try to say, listen, this is a homicide, and anybody who is the victim of a homicide has rights. And one of those rights is a full investigation. And Dorothy Kilgallen has never gotten that full investigation, and I want you to look into this. Now, will it happen? You never know, but the chances probably are not great. But at least people need to do something, and that's where I say people need to speak up about every issue that we're facing today, all this this problem with the division that we have in this country, and all of that. So the only thing that is the wrong thing to do is not to do something. And if people feel strongly about this, they can get in touch with me through my website, markshawbooks.com. And I can tell them, hey, I hope you'll try to do something here, because we're all looking for the truth.
The book is out and available. You can also get The Poison Patriarch, How the Betrayals of Joseph P. Kennedy Caused the Assassination of JFK. And we will have links up to that and the reporter who knew too much, the mysterious death of What's My Line TV star and media icon Dorothy Kilgallen. We'll have those up if you go to darknessradio.com. Click on the Killer Deals link. It'll take you into our Amazon page so that you can find the books of that guest and all of the other guests that you hear featured on True Crime Tuesday and on Beyond the Darkness. I want to thank everybody for tuning in and checking that out. And thank you so much for being a part of the show with us today, Mark, and sharing a different and unique perspective on the Kennedy assassination.
Well, thank you, Dave. I most appreciate it. And so does Dorothy Kilgallen.
I appreciate that. All right, guys, let's open up the news files here and take a look at what's going on in the world of dumb crimes and stupid criminals. Seems our first story up is, it's one for the ages. A man has been charged with trying to pay for fast food with cocaine. Believe it or not, this one comes to us from Rockford, Illinois, where a 34-year-old man is arrested after a restaurant employee says he tried to pay for his food with drugs. The Winnebago County Sheriff's Office says Daryl Ross was arrested at a restaurant in the area of Harrison and Stowmarket Avenue Saturday. An employee tells deputies that when she went to hand Ross his food in the drive-thru, he handed her four small baggies with White Rock substance inside. She did not give Ross his food and instead went to Boone County Sheriff's deputy, who was inside the restaurant at the time. The Boone County deputy detained Ross in the parking lot and waited until Winnebago County deputies tested the baggies. Investigators say they found seven baggies that tested positive for cocaine and two that tested positive for heroin. The four baggies handed to the employee tested positive for heroin. Deputies say Ross was arrested on charges of possession with intent to deliver 15 grams of cocaine, possession of controlled substance, and possession of controlled substance heroin. His bond set for $50,000. Swapping out a little bit of the old white horse for a burger. Nice. Five naked Canadians were arrested after crashing their car and being charged with kidnapping an entire family, including a six-week-old baby. That's according to police reports. The five naked Canadians drank a hallucinogenic tea with their breakfast before forcing the Leduc County couple and their baby into a BMW against their will. The couple and their infant were abducted from their Kisku home in Alberta around 9:30 a.m. earlier this week. The kidnapping suspects were arrested on the street after the car crash, Royal Canadian Mounted Police Corporal Laurel Scott told the press. The extremely cold weather conditions and 17-degree temperature in Alberta did not appear to faze the five naked Canadians when they were being handcuffed and placed in police cruisers, the Daily Mail reports. The five naked Canadians allegedly forced their father into the trunk of the BMW. He was able to escape from the trunk, and his wife and baby somehow managed to escape later from inside the car. One of the naked kidnapping suspects brought the hallucinogenic tea home with them after a trip to India. A relative of one of the alleged kidnappers said, "Drinking the tea prompted a whole crazy spell that led to the arrests," according to the National Post. The relative cannot be named by the Canadian press because of a rule banning the identification that relates to many minors involved in a criminal case. The relative went on to deem the events of the day as absolutely crazy. He said the group was planning on having a nice morning together, and then the gathering developed into multiple felony arrests. Oh, Canada. The unidentified relative also revealed his ex-wife and their two teenage daughters were having breakfast with a man and his wife who had just returned from a vacation in India and consumed the tea. He was not aware of the hallucinogenic tea or what it contained. The father of the two teenage girls who drank the tea with their mother and her friends said none of the individuals involved are bad, but adding that they simply drank some trippy tea. When the story about the five naked Canadians went viral, he said he laughed about the odd incident, but was soon reduced to a state of silent shock when he discovered his normally straight-laced teens and ex-wife were involved. He also said the family that was abducted are friends of the naked kidnappers and are not holding a grudge over the incident. According to the father of the teenage girls, none of those involved in the kidnapping tested positive for illicit drugs, leading him to believe the tea was both herbal and extremely potent. Canadian police officers arrested three adults and charged them with both kidnapping and resisting arrest. The two teenage passengers were not charged with any crime. The BMW driven by the naked Canadians allegedly collided intentionally with a truck in front of them because they thought they had been kidnapped by its driver. No one was seriously injured in the crash. Oh, my God. Now you have to worry about spiked, drugged, hallucinogenic tea. Oh, it's always something. Let's see. Massachusetts police stop a vehicle with a pizza box license plate. This is brilliant. November 16th, this story comes to us. A Massachusetts police department said a driver is facing charges for making their own license plate out of a pizza box and magic markers. The Hopkintown Police Department said the driver of a Buick Century was pulled over when the police noticed the vehicle's license plate was an obvious forgery. The department said in a Facebook post, the driver is now facing charges. The post read, "Here's a little advice to those aspiring to make their own license plates. One, don't. Two, but But if you do, make sure not to use cardboard from a pizza box and magic markers. Charges for this creative operator include operating an uninsured and unregistered vehicle and attaching fake homemade plates. Genius. Total genius. Oh, here we go. This is the kind of story. It's a feel-good story. And a man wearing only black high heels and a tight black t-shirt randomly barged into a Rutherford home, frightening a husband and wife who were home watching television, police said. Justin Paul Cristoro, 39, an attorney, yelled, "I'm here," when he walked in through the back door of the Eastern Way home. Shortly before 5 p.m. on Saturday, according to police. "I'm home." No explanation was offered as to why he chose the Rutherford residence. Rutherford Police Captain Patrick A. Feliciano said he does not even know the Rutherford residence. Several hours later, he was found sleeping in his car while parked in the driveway of a home on Lake Avenue in Lindenhurst, still clad in only the heels and a t-shirt, according to the police. Police said that when they woke Cristoro, he seemed out of it and didn't know how he got there. Authorities said they found a plastic bag containing ecstasy in the car. Cristoro was issued a summons by Rutherford police for criminal trespass, and Lindhurst gave him summonses for possession of a controlled dangerous substance, lewdness, and a motor vehicle violation for blocking a driveway. He was transported to Newbridge Medical Center in Paramus because police believed he was under the influence of a substance, they say. No kidding. He's due in Bergen County Central Judicial Processing Court on November 29th. We will keep you updated with that genius story right there as new facts develop. All right, a convicted felon was arrested in connection with a series of home burglaries in the Metro Phoenix after he left his resume inside one house and his cell phone inside another, according to Maricopa County Superior Court documents. Aaron Sullivan, age 39, is accused of stealing items worth more than $225,000 from multiple homes within the past month, according to the court documents. Sullivan entered a Scottsdale house near Hayden Road and 80th Place through an unlocked back door October 24th, police say in court records. The documents state the victim later noticed nearly $15,000 of jewelry as well as a handgun were missing. The victim also found a black binder that did not belong to anyone in the home. The Scottsdale police officers who responded to the incident opened the binder and found Sullivan's resume. This led to a background check in which officers found Sullivan to be an 11-time convicted felon who was on probation and had been released from prison in June of 2016, according to the court documents. Sullivan's probation officer said the man was working as a salesman going door-to-door, court records say. On November 3rd, detectives linked Sullivan to home burglaries in other areas, including Phoenix and Surprise. The Surprise Police Department confirmed camera equipment and a gaming system were stolen from a home in Surprise. Detectives found another burglary in Phoenix connected to Sullivan, in which the homeowner reported more than $200,000 in bags, jewelry, watches, and luggage had been stolen. Sullivan had left his cell phone in that home. When questioned, Sullivan denied any involvement in the burglaries, despite some of the stolen items being found in his home. According to records, officials found luxury watches hidden in the cereal boxes in Sullivan's kitchen. The documents state that additional items from different residential burglaries were found. Some items, such as gaming systems and camera equipment, were recovered, according to officials. Sullivan is being charged with theft and multiple counts of burglary, according to the records. Just goes to show you, don't take your resume with. Yeah, you might bump into somebody you might want to hand it into, but that just doesn't seem to be a good way to do it, hanging out at a burglary with your resume in hand. And if you do, don't set it down. A pink floral nightgown and black lipstick didn't help a bank teller who was immediately recognized by former colleagues when she held up her former workplace, stealing $126,000, according to court documents. Latasha Gamble, 24, is accused of robbing the Chase Bank branch at gunpoint November 9th on Tuesday. A judge ordered Gamble detained, according to court records. Gamble, who is charged with bank robbery, was taken into custody a few hours later after the heist at another branch of the same bank when she reported for work as a teller, according to court records. Gamble entered the bank at 3956 North Sheridan Road around 9:30 a.m., sat in a waiting area fidgeting with dog biscuits they give to customers' pets, according to the complaint against her. A staffer spotted her and noticed something felt off, according to the criminal complaint filed Monday. She then walked to the teller window and told the teller she needed to show them some documents, but pulled a thin-barreled black semi-automatic handgun and pointed it at a banker. "Let's go to the vault," she said, according to the complaint. Gamble shoved the banker into the back and demanded they open the vault, the complaint said. When the banker told her that we require dual control, Gamble grabbed a teller by the hair, pulling the teller toward the vault and demanded they enter their access codes, the complaint said. "If you look at me, I'll shoot," she said to them, according to the complaint. After the robber fled with more than $126,000, the bank staffers told authorities they were about 70% sure the robber was their former co-worker. Staffers later identified her by voice, lips, height, and weight. Staffers told officials the robber was wearing a dark-colored knit hat, a dark curly wig, black lipstick, black winter glove, a puffy winter coat, and a pink nightgown with a floral pattern and white shoes, the complaint said. Plaintiff wore a disguise, though the bank employees recognized her as someone they used to work with, according to the complaint. After initially claiming she was with a relative that morning and saying that the gun was a toy she bought at Walmart, Gamble confessed to the heist, according to court documents. Gamble's defense attorney said during the Tuesday hearing that she is a high school graduate with no criminal history and no substance abuse or apparent financial problems. The attorney said the conduct was an aberration because she seemed to have no reason to have committed this crime, according to court documents. Gamble, who had worked for the bank for a year, was living with her grandmother, her parents, her young son, and a sister, and the sister's child. The cash, which Gamble said she hid in a dumpster, has not been found. Gamble is scheduled for another court appearance next week. Oh, man, that's brutal. You steal all that money, put it in a dumpster. Here we go. Oh, this guy looks great. Vero Beach, Florida. A Vero Beach family woke up to a man stomping on their roof, the Indian River Sheriff's Office says. When deputies arrived, they say Jacob Futch claimed he was having a meeting with a DEA agent on the roof of their home. The family told deputies that they don't know Futch, and Futch admitted to not knowing who the agent is, according to the arrest report. A man living in the home told deputies he and his three young sons woke up to Futch yelling, howling, and walking down the road at 6 a.m. on November 11th. 2 hours later, the man says they woke up again after hearing Futch on the roof of his home. When Futch was asked if he was under the influence, he said he had injected meth at approximately 2 a.m., Futch is facing a misdemeanor charge of trespassing. He's being held in the Indian River County Jail on just $500 bond. So if you have $500 sitting around, Mr. Futch would love you to stop by and pay his way out. Let's see what we've got here. Yes. Florida man throws his girlfriend's shoe out of his truck to stop her from strangling him, police say. We're going to Conewago Township, York County. A Florida man had to throw his girlfriend's shoe out of his truck window to get her to stop attacking him, according to a police arrest report. Stacy Stringfellow of Sarasota, Florida, was charged with strangulation and harassment, the arrest affidavit says. The incident happened Tuesday at 11:30 p.m. at a distribution warehouse on Susquehanna Trail North, according to Northern York County Regional Police. Police were called to the location for a report of a woman who was standing on a loading dock screaming about being assaulted by her boyfriend, police say. The initial report said the woman was wearing just one shoe. An officer made contact with the woman, later identified as Stringfellow. She told police that she and her boyfriend, Nathaniel Hugger, had driven up from Florida that morning. She said that she was searching through his email when she found evidence that he was cheating on her. When she confronted him, they began arguing in the warehouse parking lot. Stringfellow said Hugger bit her right wrist through the argument and that she somehow sustained a scratch on the inside of her head during the altercation as well. Stringfellow said she had been to the hospital earlier that day to get her psych medications and that Hugger left with them in his possession. She said she wanted the medication back, police say. While police were speaking to Stringfellow, Hugger returned to the scene and remained in his truck, the arrest affidavit states. When police talked to him, he had a different version of events. According to Hugger, Stringfellow became irate when she confronted him about his infidelity. During the confrontation, Hugger said, Stringfellow got out of the passenger seat, went behind his seat, wrapped her arm around his neck, and began choking him. Hugger said he was unable to breathe, so he moved his mouth up and down on her wrist, using his teeth to try to break her hold. Once he freed himself, Hugger said he threw one of her shoes outside the truck in an attempt to get her to exit the vehicle. Hugger told police his ploy worked. Stringfellow... What is she, a puppy? Stringfellow left left the truck to retrieve her shoe, and Hugger drove off out of fear for his own safety. Police say there were no witnesses in the area that could provide information on what actually happened. Based on the information received at the scene, police took Stringfellow into custody, the arrest affidavit states. When told she had been accused of strangling Hugger, Stringfellow allegedly said to police that she was trying to hug Hugger to calm him down, the affidavit says. She said Hugger bit her wrist while she was just hugging him, police say. It was just a case of mistaken identity. I'm not trying to choke the life out of you. I'm just hugging you very, very aggressively. And as we wrap up this week, Thanksgiving's right around the corner. Let's go to this story. Villager dressed in a turkey costume has been arrested in theft of merchandise at Belk. A 67-year-old resident of the Villages who was wearing a turkey costume was arrested in the theft of more than $1,000 in merchandise at Belk. Irene Leonhardt of the Village of County Club Hills entered the store at La Plaza Grande shortly after noon Friday. According to an arrest report from the Lady Lake Police Department, she was carrying a blue mesh bag and a small brown purse when she entered the store. She selected a Michael Kors purse, removed the paper from inside the purse, and put it into her bag. She then selected several other items, put them into her bag, and left the store. Leonhardt had taken a total of 11 items with a total of over $1,497.99, the report indicated. She was arrested on a charge of grand theft and booked at the Lake County Jail on $5,000 bond. I guess her only hope at this point is when the president does the turkey pardon, maybe she'll be the one he chooses this year. That's it for today, folks. Be kind, love one another, have a fantastic Thanksgiving, and thank you for being a part of our world. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader, and we're thankful you're here and spending your time with us in True Crime Tuesday.